Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we talk about Clybourne Park, One Man, Two Governors, Peter and the Starcatcher, and some news from around This Week on Broadway.
And she moved down to the coast. She's a first-class kind of woman. She's the girl I love the most.
She got cursor miles on end, and they drive you round the bend. When she runs, it's like a glimpse of the divine. And the thrills are guaranteed when you ride her at full speed on the London to Brighton line.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, April 22nd, 2012. My name is James Marino, and on the recording this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a writer. You can see his writing at the New York Star Ledger. He also writes for Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, for Kritzerland on Fridays, and in the MTI blog all throughout the week. Peter, good morning.
Hi.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You could see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You could also see his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. Michael writes for other outlets such as NPR and the Sondheim Review. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
We are very busy into our openings, and you two are frantically seeing shows six and seven and eight nights a week, I'd imagine, if you were seeing the Beatles. But
the Beatles?
8 days, you know.
8 days a week. It's nice. You know, in London, there's the museum ads for the Beatles Museum does say open 8 days a week.
That's great. Speaking of which, you guys saw Clybourne Park, and Michael has a lot to say about this. Michael, why don't you start us off with Clybourne?
Michael has a minority report, apparently. It's interesting to me, and it's a little disconcerting. You know, in the old days, we would read, you know, before the internet, I think we would read a certain number of reviews in the papers. And then, of course, we would see some reviews on TV. But now with the internet, of course, and sites like Broadway Stars, it's quite easy to seek out all of the major reviews of a show. And the thing that you find that this has taught me is that in almost every case, nobody agrees on anything. Even the biggest hit or the biggest flop, even the biggest hit tends to have its detractors, and even the biggest flop tends to have its champions. And I mean, of course, that was always true. It's just that it's more evident now in the internet age, because it's so easy to find these comments and reviews. So I think this is the first time when I have had a completely opposite reaction to all of the major reviews. I cannot understand the success of this play. I think I'm surprised and disappointed that it won the Pulitzer over, I'm sure, other things that I would consider to be far superior. I'm truly mystified, and it's really I've been thinking about it a lot, because when something like that happens, I think you really have to think about it and say, is it me or is it everyone else? I shouldn't say I'm mystified at its commercial success, because I guess I can understand that the play is about race, and it's about how even now, still, you know, in 2012 or whatever, it's such a hot button issue and so difficult for people, you know, for white and black people, for example, to discuss together. It consists of a lot of what I consider to be cheap, stereotypical humor. And also a lot of it is just about what I just said. It's about how difficult it is to talk about it without people getting all upset and things like that. But I don't think, I guess maybe that hasn't been covered in too many plays yet. Maybe that's why people still find it interesting to watch. I should have made a list of movies and plays that do cover that specific subject. I mean, Crash is, you know, leaps to mind as a very successful movie that's about the subject of race from both the black and white perspective. I mean, that's my only explanation for this. But I think the writing is very, very poor in one sense. I do think that the concept is great. For those of you who don't know, Act One of the play is set in 1959. And what we see is it's set in the house that the younger family in the wonderful Lorraine Hansberry play, A Raisin in the Sun, is about to purchase. The black younger family is about to move into in a previously all-white neighborhood. And so we never see the Youngers, but we see the white family that's about to move out of the house, and we learn why they're about to move out, and et cetera. And then Act Two is set 50 years later in the same house, the same room of the same house, and the house has now become abandoned, and it basically become a crack house. Almost completely trashed. There's graffiti all over the walls, and now it's come full circle. And now a white family is about to purchase the house. Purchase the land, because their plan is to completely raise the house and build a new one. So it's kind of like the cycle of gentrification or de-gentrification and different, you know, ghettoization and non-ghettoization and integration and things like that. And so all of that is very interesting. But and I would also say, just to get all the good out of the way, if I can, that the dialogue of the play, which is written by Bruce Norris, does seem to me, for the most part, very natural. I mean, he has a good ear for writing the way people actually speak, and that is a not inconsiderable talent, because so many people cannot do that, I think. But having said that, I don't know. I think there's a lot of cheap humor. I think there's a lot of shock humor. Act Two revolves most of the laughs in Act Two, or many of them anyway, the biggest laughs, revolve around three or four ethnic jokes that presumably Norris did not write himself. I've heard at least one of them before. So that seems kind of like a cheat to me. The play is about the difficulty of discussing this subject, but it does show that in a very kind of superficial, sensationalistic way, but it doesn't, I don't think there's anything deeper to it than that. And I don't know. I think a Pulitzer Prize winning hit Broadway play should be a little deeper than that. What else did I want to say? There are a lot of things in it that just do not make any sense whatsoever. And that took me out of the play continually. For example, in Act Two, as I said, it's set in the same room of the same house. And we're supposed to believe that this is the site of a meeting of the white couple that is planning to purchase the house. A black couple who represents, I guess, a neighborhood group, the female of whom is supposed to be the great grandniece, I believe, of the central character of Raisin in the Sun, Lena Younger. There's a lawyer, a white lawyer present, and a person who's supposed to be a mediator. And it's like, well, why would they ever be meeting in the house? It really, I mean, we know why. It's to show the coup de théâtre, if you will, of the house looking just lovely and sweet and very homey in Act One, and then being trashed in Act Two. Kind of the reverse of, sort of the reverse of Barefoot in the Park. You know,
and the Odd Couple.
And the Odd Couple. Yes. Right. Oh, thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah. It's just like it seems so so schematic and so silly and so manipulated by the writer that they would be in the meeting would be taking place in that house. It doesn't make any sense at all. We're also told, unless I misunderstood, in Act Two, there was mention of the fact that the house has been landmarked. But if it were landmarked, then they wouldn't be able to tear it down and build a new one. So I didn't understand that part. What else? And then finally, we learn the reason why, or one of the reasons why the White family is moving out in Act One. They have had a tragedy, which I guess I shouldn't say more about. But I don't see how that tragedy relates to anything, has any relation really whatsoever in terms of what the larger theme, if you will, of the play is. And it provides, a supposedly very stunning moment at the end of Act Two, but not for me, because again, I didn't quite see what the relationship was. So I'm quite mystified. I think it's and I'm very surprised again that so many of the critics have been raving so positively about it, because it does seem so superficial and so kind of again schematic and full of cheap humor, and I'm not I'm very, very surprised. And so maybe Peter can explain to me, because I believe he did not have the same reaction.
Well, Peter, why don't you explain it to us?
Oh, I don't know if I can explain it. But it is true I didn't have the same reaction, but I wasn't over the moon about this play. I do think it's good. I like certain things about it. I will tell you this, any woman who attends, who's afraid during intermission that she's not going to have enough time to go to the ladies' room, yes, she does. This is one of the longest intermissions on record, because they do have to change every wall of that set and plenty of other things, too. I can't ever recall a longer intermission, so rest easy. Even though the restrooms for the men at the Kerr I find very small, I don't know what they are for the ladies, but all right, to the play. I look at this play as a situation where I'm looking at the glasses half full rather than half empty. What I like about the second act of the play is that the black people have been empowered in 50 years. The black people we see in the first act are a maid of a white couple and a handyman. And the maid has a bit more backbone than her husband, the handyman, because there's one point where she says, "We are going." And he volunteers to take down a trunk from upstairs. And she says, "No, we're going." And what's interesting is that later on, they return. She's furious, but you can tell that they had an argument. Come on, why can't I help them? What's wrong with that? You are not helping them. You're not being paid for this. Do not do it. Oh, come on. They're nice people. They've been good to you. Maybe you should do it. You know, they're your bosses. Maybe you'll get in trouble if indeed we don't do it. This will help you to keep your job. Again, none of this is a conversation we hear. This is something I'm inferring. But nevertheless, they do return, and he does help bring down the trunk from the attic. All right, so these are people who are in a situation where they're worried about their lives and their jobs. So in the second act, it's very nice to see the black couple on equal footing in terms of status and power. They are equal partners in this discussion. It is true that the conversation does devolve as time goes on, but nobody looks good as time goes on. So there's a great deal of interesting dialogue in the beginning, in the first act, about where you see the white people trying to really convince themselves that they are wonderful people where it comes to dealing with blacks. The only line that I missed hearing, which I fully expected was going to be coming, is that the white mistress of the house was going to say about the black maid, "She's just like one of the family," you know, because that's a very big cliche from the 50s about maids in the households. That I remember my former mother-in-law having a black maid and saying, "She's just like one of the family." I remember that vividly. And then I remember some years later saying, "Well, we had to fire Ethel because she just couldn't work anymore." Well, so much for one of the family. So What I do think is nice in terms of Raisin in the Sun, which, by the way, whenever I'm asked for the 10 greatest plays in the history of mankind, I always include Raisin in the Sun because of what it did. People who walked into that theater back in the 50s to see Raisin in the Sun were white people who thought, I do not want black people living next door to me. And I think when they came out of that theater, they thought, oh, really, what's the problem? So I think that's a very significant play. And what this play does address is how the Youngers could afford the house, because indeed it was sold at a fire sale rate. Now, the reason that happened is something that comes out in the first act, why the people are just so anxious to get rid of it. And I do think Bruce Norris did a very good job in coming up with a plausible reason for why that would happen. I'm surprised that there's so much talk about how this in the second act, about how this neighborhood is a terrific neighborhood. It's on the rise. It's great. You know, everybody is, it's hot. And this house is in the middle of it. I mean, it seems odd to me that this one house would be so plagued in a neighborhood that's supposedly so good. But
yes.
You know, I thought that was really odd. I couldn't see with – I would think there would have been much more outrage about this house being in the condition it is. If it's this bad inside, it's probably very bad outside. It's gone to rack and ruin. I'm sorry. It breaks my heart to see the Younger house that that they obviously strove so hard to get, you know, after losing the $10,000 and all that. It's so hard for me to think that this is what's become of this house. As a big fan of Raisin in the Sun, that hurt me. But, you know, I know that's not the point, but nevertheless, it's something I couldn't help thinking of. I
think on that note, Peter,
Maybe
you can, I'm not sure if I missed it, if there was any explanation of exactly how long the Youngers owned it and
right
and what happened.
What happened?
Was there?
No, not that I can see.
Yeah, I don't think
I didn't have the reaction Michael did, but nevertheless, and I don't begrudge it, its success or the Pulitzer Prize, I wouldn't be surprised if in another year, in a different year is what I mean, it wouldn't have won the prize. But it's done very well in London, too. So I didn't find it as funny as most people do. But and I do think that the choice to make the acting over the top, this is a choice that happens in the first act, because the mistress of the house certainly is almost cartoonish, but I can tell that they want the sitcom-y type of atmosphere here. I understand that. It's a choice they've made. It's not my first choice, but I can live with it, and I accepted it as a choice to indicate how silly we were about certain things in the 50s. For example, the woman just thinks she is being so gracious in giving her maid a chafing dish, which indeed, you know, she has no need for. But this is her way of feeling, oh, I'm so good to my help. Oh, aren't I wonderful with the colored people? That type of thing. And so I understand the choice. I'd like to see this play without that choice made in terms of direction. And I guess as time goes on, there will be productions where somebody will take a different tack. I'll be interested in seeing it again then. But I think it's good. I don't think it's great.
All righty. So, you know, it reminds me of different things that we think might work on Broadway very well. One of them is a film from last year that got a lot of acclaim called The Help. And I think we pondered last year on the podcast here if that could transfer to the Broadway stage well, but we'll have to see. All right, let's move on to another Broadway opening, One Man, Two Governors. And Peter, why don't you start with that one?
A farce based on Servant of Two Masters, set in 1963. And they make that very apparent when you come into the show, because there's a very Beatle-like group singing songs, original songs, by the way, and somewhat in the Beatles mode, not quite. They're dressed somewhat like the Beatles did back in those days, too. So this is actually, of course, the Beatles before they really made it big in America, which didn't happen until the end of 63, early 64. Because everybody talks about the Ed Sullivan Show on February 9th, but I remember vividly that December 4th is when I Want to Hold Your Hand hit the charts. Anyway, One Man, Two Governors. All right, James Carden is the guy who is the one man who is going to serve two governors, and he has certainly a tough time doing it, trying to keep information from the other, from both are supposed to be men, but one actually isn't. And I'm very surprised at the beginning of the show, it's established that there are twins. One's a man and one's a woman. Okay. The man has died. And in comes a woman dressed like a man, and everybody thinks that the man didn't die, but that they were mistaken. Nobody says, you know, this could very well be the woman dressed like a man. The fact that she looks like a woman, I always question this type of casting. I would really cast, especially these days, I would cast a woman who doesn't particularly look obviously feminine. Such women exist, of course, and I would like to see a convincing-looking Peter Pan. I would like to see a convincing-looking, all those Shakespeare heroines. But this woman is clearly a woman. So the fact that they know that there's a man and a woman twin situation, I would think would spill the beans right away. So that surprises me. Keeping them the information from that they're twins would have been smart. All right. Well, Jane, the thing I resented about the play, and I feel bad about saying this because these are spoilers and there's no way around it, but I smelled a rat. certainly twice in the show. I'm going to give one away. I think that's the fair way of doing it. But I knew just from the fact that when James Carden from the stage said, "I'm hungry, does anybody have a sandwich?" When somebody produced a sandwich, I knew he was a plant because of the way the sandwich was wrapped. I know that sounds bizarre, but it was beautifully wrapped in wax paper, which you don't even see anymore. And it was just too convenient for me. And I said, that's a plant. Are there other plants in the show? Well, there are other times when he interacts with the audience. And I will let you judge whether or not the other people that come on stage are plants. But I resent when something is supposed to be spontaneous and off the cuff, and we're in that theatrical area that movies and TVs can never give us, that is this real or isn't it? I love when it's real, but I hate when it turns out to be manufactured like that. So I have a bias against that type of thing, and certainly that happens in One Man, Two Governors. Carden's marvelous. He does everything you can possibly ask of a guy. He certainly runs around. He rolls on the floor. He's deft in the way that he lies. A lot of physical comedy, as you expect in a farce. But as I said about Tracy Bennett, which is more demanding, don't misunderstand me, but I don't know how this guy does it twice in one day, twice a week. It's just yeoman work. The rest of the cast is very good, too. And you have the standard, extraordinarily buxom woman with the Randy appetite that you certainly used to get in British farces back in the 50s and 60s, you know, from No Sex Please, We're British, all the way to one called Let's Get Laid. There was a comedy in the late 60s called Let's Get Laid. It was about a criminal named Laid, and two detectives had to get him. Let's Get Laid, you know. So anyway, true story. Anyway, you know, you have the buxom lady. You certainly have the stiff upper lip guy. And as much as you'll see a lot of stiff upper lip people on the stage, it's going to be hard for you in many instances to keep your own lip stiff, not that you want to, but because you're going to be laughing a great deal. Yes, I laughed a great deal. And yet the fact that I felt manipulated on a couple of occasions made the experience less fun for me. I would have rather that they had just done the farce without dealing with the audience, given the fact that they weren't on the up and up. So that's my tiny objection to One Man, Two Governors. But aside from that, it really is farce at its best. So when everybody's rollicking around, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
All right. Michael, what did you think?
Interesting. First of all, I'm sorry, Peter. Let me just correct Peter. It's James Corden, not Carden.
It's not pronounced? I heard it was pronounced. No? Okay.
Oh, really? I'm sorry. It's C-O-R. I don't know how that would be car, but I suppose anything's possible.
That's what I was told.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Well, anyway, it's James Corden, and he's every bit as marvelous as Peter just said. It's interesting, Peter. I know what you mean, but in this case, I did not have a problem with the plants because I think part, as Peter said, not everyone is a plant who is brought up on stage. And I think part of the fun is figuring out who is and who isn't. And in this case, they're on the up and up about it in the sense that at least one of the plants takes a curtain call. And also, the fact that I have to say, at least one of the plants does such an amazing job of acting like someone who was just plucked out of the audience and just a regular audience member, that in itself is just an incredible achievement. Not to mention the fact that Corden reacts to this person or these people in such a way that it really, well, actually to all of the people who are brought up on stage or yell out from the audience, he reacts to them in such a way that it completely seems spontaneous. And I think that's quite something to be able to create that effect, you know, to act as if it really is happening and it was unexpected and when it isn't. To me, this is a completely, completely different situation than the really reprehensible thing that happened in that Tommy Tune show where he pretended that an old dance teacher of his was in the audience and the audience was manipulated and it was never, ever, ever said that it was all a plant and it wasn't true.
Yeah, for those who didn't see the show, what Michael means is actually she came up on stage and he looked shocked and said, "Susanna?" I mean, yeah.
So I would say that's different. I guess I know what you mean, Peter, but in this case, I thought it was all part of the almost like being in a fun house, like not knowing exactly who is real and who isn't.
But what very much happens at that end of the act immediately convinces you that this could not possibly be just a genuine person from the audience.
At the end of which act?
At the end of the first act. What happens to this person?
Oh, right.
At that point, you say, no, they would never do this to the average theater goer.
Right, but to me, that was like, that only added to it because I was so convinced that it was a real person. Mm-hmm. And then the thing that happened, as you say, you know, immediately convinced you that it wasn't. And so I was very impressed and very thrilled.
It didn't keep me from laughing like a seal, by the way. I mean, you know, because it really was extraordinarily funny. I'll grant you that.
And I was trying to think, Peter, can you think of any other show that has had so much laughter throughout it?
And this is when I say yes, it's not to mean to diminish this show. Yeah. It's to elevate it. And okay. That, of course, is Noises Off.
Okay, good choice. One thing that did surprise me is that they, in Act 2, which is much shorter than Act 1 of One Man, Two Governors, they completely or almost completely eliminate any kind of audience interaction or plant interaction whatsoever. And to me, the second act was much less funny because this strikes me as a, you know, Peter was talking about the twins plot and, you know, how credible that is. To me, everything that happens in this is, you know, every element of the plot is purely as an excuse for laughter. So I didn't even spend a moment thinking about whether something was believable or not. Although normally those kind of things bother me too, as Peter well knows. So that wasn't an issue for me. But I was I did think that the laughs in Act Two were much fewer than in Act One because it was much more about the plot, which you know, I mean, it's based on a very, very old play by Carlo Goldoni, which was in turn based on, you know, basically a somewhat modern for that time take on Commedia dell'arte, which is ages old. And there was just the stuff that happened in Act One with the plants and with the real audience members interacting was so hilarious that its absence in Act Two struck me as a really big letdown. Did you feel that, Peter?
Well, of course, but I was prepared for it because everybody I knew who had seen it has said it goes on 15 or 20 minutes too long.
Oh,
you know, and what they really mean is that it doesn't keep up with what happened in the first act. So
I hadn't been told that, so I was disappointed. But only in Act Two. I mean, looking back on it, it was. I brought a friend who said, "Thank you for this gift of this show."
Sure, mine said the same thing too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is going to be the outcome of this? It seems that it got rave reviews, but I feel like both of you are lukewarm about this.
Well, no, I wouldn't say I wouldn't say I'm lukewarm overall. I'm only lukewarm about Act Two.
Okay.
But looking back on it, it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And since I don't object to the plant thing the way Peter does, for me it was an almost unalloyed delight. And I would urge everyone to see it.
I'd urge everyone to see it too. Don't misunderstand me. I just have tremendous reservations about Little Fast. It's the type of thing that sticks in my craw. Years ago, there was a play called Game Show that was down to 45 Bleecker, in which they pulled out somebody from the audience. And for the longest time, we really thought they were on the up and up. And I was so disappointed when it turned out just to be an actress. I mean, it's just not something I respond to. So that's me. Going to be interesting is going to be the race for best actor in a play, because obviously James is going to get nominated, and so is Philip Seymour Hoffman. Now, what's going to happen, because both of them got raves, both of them deserve them. Traditionally, not always, but traditionally the award goes to more of a dramatic actor than a comic actor, so that would seem to put Hoffman ahead. On the other hand, British shows tend to do well in the prestige categories, and so maybe that would give a nod to James. That import factor is always something. This was a big hit in London. Always carries weight. So it's going to be very, very compelling to see which of those two, if either of those two, winds up winning the Best Actor prize. We'll have to wait and see.
You know, what's interesting, too, was pointed out to me that I didn't realize by the friend who I brought to the show. It has been in movie theaters. The National Theater production was, well, I'm not sure if it was, you know, what if it was live, probably not. It was probably one of those.
No, I think they are live, actually.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's confusing now because some of them are live and some of them are not. But at any rate, it has been shown in theaters in the U.S. And that's a little surprising, for one thing, in the sense that it would seem to me that of all shows, this would be one where you would really want to see it. I mean, it wouldn't be the first choice for that kind of presentation, because to be in the theater and to hear that laughter going on and on, and also to experience the audience interaction thing, even if it's some of it's fake, it seems to me that that's something you'd really want to be there for rather than seeing it on a screen. But I wonder. Someone asked me if I thought that this show would tour, and I said, well, I would think that the existence of that, you know, of that film version or whatever word for it there is, might work against that on the one hand. But on the other hand, as I said, it's something you really should see live. So maybe it will tour. Who knows? I don't know.
Yes, well, this is the only one of those national broadcasts, I think, that has later come over as an actual theatrical attraction on Broadway. So the fact that they chose to do it must have at least involved some discussion. Obviously, the decision was made, oh, it's not going to hurt it. But because it is, what we're talking about is not a wide theatrical release by any means. It's only in a select number of theaters, and it's only one night. But maybe they did feel it would whet the appetite, saying, oh, wow, I can imagine how much fun this will be in a theater, and people would go again.
We've seen lots of theatrical releases in the last couple of years, you know, Chicago being one of the big ones. But we've also seen War Horse as a theatrical release last year. And War Horse at Lincoln Center is, according to Mr. Riedel, still going strong and trying to take over the Winter Garden and kick Mamma Mia out. So,
well, the other thing, too, the great granddaddy of them all, as far as this argument is concerned, might even be Phantom, because Phantom certainly had a movie, too. And it certainly hasn't hurt it from becoming what it's become.
Grease.
There was a time when, indeed, if the movie opened while the show was still running, you closed 2 weeks later. So that hasn't been the case. I mean, I know that happened with Mary Mary a few others that I can't really remember at the moment. But I remember there were certain ones that were still running when the play was on Broadway. And I'm telling you, once that movie came out, there was no interest in
Hello,
the play.
Hello, Dolly.
Dolly, I think, still ran after the movie came out, because the movie was 69.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, true. It did went a little
bit. Dolly stayed around until, I think, 71.
West Side Story did well after the movie was released.
Well, it had closed on Broadway, though.
Yeah, closed on Broadway, and then... But subsequently,
I'm really talking about the Broadway production still running while the movie happened. Yeah. So, anyway.
And I think I'm pretty sure Chicago, the film, was before the Phantom film. So, actually, that would be the... I think that maybe is the
great granddaddy. What I meant by that was the fact that the show had been running longer. Yeah, you know, I mean, after all, when Chicago opened, Phantom had already been around 7 years. Which there was a time when that was, you know, that's a by far lady run, you know, which doesn't mean much anymore.
Right.
So that's what I meant by that. That one would think that it would hurt Phantom much more, because Phantom had been running that much longer, but it certainly hasn't.
Is the success of One Man, Two Governors tied so closely with the cast that they wouldn't survive a cast replacement, or how do you feel about that?
I don't know. I think that there are plenty of low comics, and that's a compliment, by the way, who I think would do very well by the lead role. And the other parts aren't that hard to cast, I don't think. There's a waiter who has a very tough time of it, and he's marvelous in the show. But all things considered, I do think it's the other people can easily be replaced.
When you talk about audience plants, I think about Dame Edna and how Dame Edna doesn't use audience plants, as far as I can remember. Is that true?
I've never heard of anybody admitting to being a planter. I never heard that issue raised when Dame Edna did.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact that that at least one long interaction was not a plant, because it was a friend of mine.
And last but not least, it's a shame that Barry Humphries is retiring from the stage, because perhaps this could be One Dame, Two Governors.
Ah!
So, all right, let's move on to our next show, which is Peter and the Starcatcher.
I loved the show. I loved it downtown at New York Theater Workshop. I think it has transferred very well to Broadway, because even though it's intimate in a way, it's kind of epic in terms of the way the story theater aspect of it, and the devices they use are so theatrical, and the style of the acting and the directing, I would say, is large in a good way. So I really did not anticipate that it would stumble on Broadway, and it hasn't. It's a delightful show by Rick Ellis, directed by Roger Reese and Alex Timbers. based on, is it a book or a series of books that are sort of prequel to the Peter Pan story. And it's delightful and fascinating to see how the characters in Peter and the Starcatcher, it's eventually revealed how they, in some cases, become characters in Peter Pan or characters that relate to the story of Peter Pan. So I highly recommend it. The show does something that normally sets my teeth on edge, but for some reason, it didn't bother me in this case. And that is a lot of very up-to-the-date, jokey pop culture references, such as, for example, TTFN. They say to each other, ta-ta for now. That's just one example. And there's one reference that was so pop cultural that it went completely over my head to the point that I can't even quote it back to you. If I see the show again, I'm going to try to make a note of it and ask somebody what that was, because I really have no idea. But that was the only one. It's very theatrical, very delightful. Another thing the show does that can set my teeth on edge, but did not in this case, was that it has adults playing children. But I think it's very well done, as it was in the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. And in fact, one of the cast members is a veteran of that show, Celia Keenan Bolger, who is one of my favorites. And then also Adam Chandler Barat, who plays one of the other major characters, and who many of us may know from Next to Normal. Also, I think he does an equally good job of playing a child without being cloying and annoying. But really, many of the cast play children, and they all do it extremely well. And Christian Borle is a completely hilarious delight as the character Black Stash, and I'm so sure you could probably figure out who he turns out to be. As I think I may have said before on a podcast, Christian, the entire cast, was in the show Downtown, and when it was announced that the show was coming to Broadway, it looked for a while as if Christian would not be able to be in it because he is on Smash in a major role. But I guess because Smash films in New York, they somehow worked it out. And I was very glad. And in a way, I was not surprised, because I literally said to someone, I cannot imagine them doing this show without him. Not that there is no one else in the world who could play the role and play it very well, but he just, when you see it, you'll know what I mean. It's so well tailored to his talents, and he's delightful in it, and so, so funny. And I think he has a very, very good chance of winning a Tony, even against huge competition such as James Corden. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. I'd hate to be a Tony voter this year, I'm telling you.
Peter.
I don't know. Will he be in that category?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah.
Because really, he doesn't have much to do until the second act. And I was surprised because it seemed to me when I saw it Downtown, he had more to do. I'm not saying he did. I'm not saying they cut a word. I suspect it's the same show. But somehow he seemed to be in it more in the...
in Act One especially.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. It could be that I'm just so used to seeing him on Smash now that... I think of him as a bigger presence. It's almost odd at the beginning to see him as part of an ensemble, because it starts with the entire ensemble getting out there and saying a line or two each to set up the situation. And he seems so diminished to me, just having this line here and there. It's a remarkable performance. He is just great. I hope he's in the featured category so he won't have to be up against those two and that he will win. I want him to win because I think he's really astonishing very, very funny. A lot of people have said to me, oh, he's over the top. Captain Hook? Are you kidding me? You know, I mean, really? They said, well, you know, Sir Richard, are you kidding me? I mean, you know, this is a character that really demands that type of situation. It's very nice to put the pieces together. Rick Elise has done a sensational job of imagining what might have happened before we got to Neverland in the way that we did. And it all fits together very, very nicely. I wonder if enough people know Peter Pan today. I have no idea what the perception is of Peter Pan today. My generation grew up knowing it tremendously, of course, from the Mary Martin broadcast. But I don't know if there's any perception of that today. I know there was a movie about 10 years ago that I liked very much, especially because Peter looked dirty, and you must get dirty on that living that life. You know, his feet were filthy. Yeah, I mean, you know, Mary Martin was immaculate. You know, so. But I don't know what people know about Peter Pan today, and I don't think it's essential to know what Peter Pan is to have a good time, because it's brilliantly directed. Whatever category Christian Bale is in, or the other ones are in. I mean, this has got to be a major contender for direction, because it's such a hard show to pull off. A million things happen. So I love the direction of it. And also, have you ever seen a more beautiful proscenium arch in your life? No. What they have done inside the Atkinson is really glorious, yeah, in terms of that proscenium arch. So a lot of fun. And you know, I wonder how much Mr. Ball will help it in terms of, oh, let's go see him. I don't know if there's that much of a perception that he's in it. I don't know if there's that much of loyalty to Smash, that people are interested in people in Smash in that way, that they would go see them live. I have no idea, because technically there are no stars in this show. He's the closest thing they have to a star. Yes, Celia Keenan-Bolger is a wonderful actress. She's not a star yet. She deserves to be. Certainly, she's a magnificent talent. And maybe Adam does have a few fans from Next to Normal. But this is a big risky venture, because there are so many people in it. It's a very expensive show. And I wish it well. It's lofty. It's intelligent. It's funny, certainly, but it's intelligent fun. And as a result, it has my endorsement, because I love when Broadway theater is smart. And this is certainly a smart show.
And you know what struck me? It's really interesting. We have at least three cases now on Broadway of quote-unquote straight plays that have a lot of music in them.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I'm gonna go out on a limb and say I won't be surprised at all if One Man, Two Governors gets a Best Score nomination. I don't think that's impossible at all.
Hmm. No, I don't think. In fact, they put out a cast album.
And yeah, it's, right.
And it's of the songs, and it's quite full, you know, mm-hmm. As opposed to. But anyway, the three shows for the record are Peter and the Starcatcher, One Man, Two Governors, and End of the Rainbow. All of which have live music. I hasten to add. In the case of Peter and the Starcatcher, the musicians are in the boxes, which creates a really nice effect. In One Man, Two Governors, there's a band that actually comes out on stage at several, and they do a pre-show for about 15 minutes of several songs, and then they come back basically for the scene changes, all of the scene changes, and it's a lot of music. It's just an interesting thing how these things go in cycles, it would seem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't mean to, but they seem to.
Yeah, right.
All righty. So three Broadway shows in 1 week, and next week there's a lot more than three. What are you guys looking like for next week? Are you jammed seven nights?
Streetcar opens tonight, so that's one that that's about to be with us.
Yeah, Streetcar is tonight. Ghost is tomorrow night. The Lions is the same night tomorrow. Both on Monday night.
Really? Nice. Wow.
Don't dress for dinner.
Don't Dress for Dinner is coming, but after the Lions on Monday, on Tuesday is Nice Work If You Can Get It. Wednesday is The Columnist. On Thursday is Don't Dress for Dinner and Leap of Faith.
And whether or not I should or should be doing this on Tuesday night, I'll be at Carnegie Hall for that Sound of Music concert.
Oh, that's so, right.
And that's happening too.
What do you mean? What do you mean? Whether or not I should be doing this?
Well, my point is that it is such a busy time. You know, I mean, to fit that in wasn't easy.
It's a luxury, isn't it?
You know. So, but I was in the mood to see what this would be like.
Well, it sounds really. I mean, I didn't want to miss it. I'm going to.
It's, oh, you're going too? Oh, how
yes.
Funny.
It's and it's Laura Osnes as Maria. It's mm-hmm. Tony Goldwyn as Captain Von Trapp. It's the mm-hmm. great opera singer Stephanie Blythe. There's the Mother Abbess. It's Brooke Shields as the Baroness, which that I'm curious to see, if only because the original role is sort of written for a soprano, and I've never known her to be a soprano, so I wonder what they're going to do with that. That should be interesting.
Yeah, that sounds like a really great evening, right? You know, it's all feast or famine. It all happens all at once. Then we have to make a Sophie's choice, don't we?
And we know why it happens all at once, but we sort of also wish that maybe there was a way that it couldn't. It would be. I think ultimately it would be better for everyone concerned if shows could open more, if the openings could be staggered more throughout the season, especially. In the case of, I mean, we understand why the really risky ones, the ones that are not anticipated to have a huge following from the beginning, might want to open right before Tony time in order to get that extra boost, especially straight plays and dramas and things like that. But, Newsies did open at least a little bit ago. So, but that's the kind of thing that might have opened. Real early in the season and not had a problem with getting audiences anyway without the Tony hype.
So I'm going to jump in my time machine and flash forward to April 22nd, 2013. If you guys had to guess a year from today, are we going to be able to talk about The Elephant Man on Broadway or Bradley Cooper?
Oh.
Entirely possible. Certainly, Williamstown gets a lot of attention, and
I can't imagine why Bradley Cooper would do a show at Williamstown unless they were really testing the waters to see if it would if it's worth bringing in.
Maybe, but that's traditionally been a venue where a lot of high profile people go and ply their wares, to exercise their theatrical muscles for a summer.
Have you guys seen Bradley Cooper and other stuff on stage?
No, I have no knowledge of his doing anything else. But my point is that you might be surprised to see who's played Williamstown, especially yes. when Nikos Sakharopoulos was there. I mean,
no, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. But Bradley Cooper, he is much, much in demand in Hollywood. I can't
sure.
imagine that he's not got 11 different things lined up for this summer
sure.
that he's got to spend some time unless they are scheduling it.
Well, I can certainly see him, if it's well received, doing a limited run on Broadway. I guess
without
saying it would be a limited run. He's not going to be in it for certainly not more than 6 months, I would say, at the absolute, outside. I'm curious to, I hope I can get up there. It's a bit of a trek. And the last revival, the revival, I guess I should say, the Broadway revival, was not that well received. It was somehow it didn't quite gel to me. Billy Crudup played the lead, and he himself said to me in an interview that he was not that happy with the way it turned out or with his performance in it, which I thought was interesting.
Bradley Cooper, I'm sure that if I don't mention this, our email's going to be ablaze. Bradley Cooper did 3 Days of Rain, but we must have forgotten that because mm-hmm. Julia Roberts and Paul Rudd were in it as well.
He was, to me, the best one in it. She was by far the most at sea. That was a very unfortunate case of stunt casting that did not pan out. I think also not well directed by Joe Mantello. So yes, but he, as I recall, he was just fine at it. And I think he got some of the best reviews also.
Also in the news, Water by the Spoonful won the Pulitzer. I saw some very, very funny posts that various nonprofit theaters were all scrambling to try and fit that into their schedule next year now. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, to me, it's interesting that I have not seen or read the play, but it's interesting that it's by the woman who wrote or co-wrote the book for In the Heights, Maria Alegria Hudes. It's nice to see a musical theater person, get a Pulitzer, even if it's not for a musical.
Next, last week we recorded on Sunday, and we did not talk about the Oliviers, but they happened, and Matilda did very, very well. And so, again, we're jumping in our time machine. I think we're going to be talking a lot about Matilda in 2013.
I like Matilda amazingly. Certainly the kid I saw was extraordinary in it. They gave all the kids an Olivier, and I hope they're as good as the kid I saw. I don't like the score very much, but I certainly like what the show has to say. And I certainly wish it well when it comes here. What surprised me, did anybody have this reaction, is that it set the record for the most Oliviers ever, and that was 7. Now, I don't know about you, but 7 seems low to me. I mean, like, for example, the Broadway record is, what, 12 from the producers, 11, 12, 10, whatever it is. I mean, I'm amazed that no London show. Maybe they have far fewer categories.
Maybe they also have – would you say they still have more shows than Broadway?
Oh, I think so. I think the West End does.
It seems and, like and their the categories moment are, their categories empty. Are much combined.
Yeah, so it's got to be that, because, I mean, 7 just doesn't sound like an overwhelming number to me.
Right.
So, I mean, to be the all-time record, you know, so...
I'm not 100% sure, but I think that they don't split out musicals and plays into different categories. I think there's a best actor in a show or a best actress in a show. I don't think that they split them out between best actors in a play.
I haven't looked that carefully at them, frankly.
All righty, and forever keeping my... my list, running streak of mispredictions. The King's Speech, which after it won the Academy Award, I said would make a great show, is going to close in the West End early. So who knows if it's going to make it here or not.
Well, there's a rebuttal to the old movie play thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So.
Exactly. All righty. And before we run, I want to point out that yesterday... up in Boston, there was a baseball game. There was, and that the Yankees were down 9 runs in the 7th inning and then scored 15 unanswered runs. And so, Mr. Felicia, I throw it back to you. We won this one yesterday.
I wish you'd remember that I have no affinity for the Red Sox whatsoever.
I know. I have nobody to battle on this, you know.
I understand.
If we get Carrie O'Malley on the podcast, do you guys know Carrie from various different shows? That she just did the Harry Connick play.
Is she a Red Sox fan, or is that what you
mean? Oh, my goodness gracious.
Oh, yeah?
Carrie personifies the Red Sox. In fact, she has sung the national anthem there a number of times. And,
I see.
And in fact, Carrie took me to a Yankee game. So it's very funny. She is passionate about her Boston teams.
You know, I dare say, though, we certainly won't get into baseball very much here, but I will say that's the type of thing that could really only happen in Fenway Park because it's such an intimate ballpark that I once heard, I don't know if this is true, that there was never a shutout in Fenway Park, which can't be true, but nevertheless, I think it's meant as a metaphor that it's an easy place to score runs. Anyway, enough. I apologize.
All righty. So I want to remind everybody that you could subscribe to these podcasts by going to BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe button there. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded for you and you won't miss anything. Of course, you don't have to listen to it in iTunes. You can listen to it in many other ways. You can get the stick Stitcher app. That's S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R, which is an app for your iPhone or your Android or your BlackBerry device. That way you can listen to us on the go and don't have to sync up. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us various times during the week. We can be found on Broadway World Radio on Thursdays at 7. We can be Wednesdays at noon and Saturdays at 2 p.m. So do that as well. Also, when you're at Broadway Radio, please take the Broadway Radio survey. Let us know what your listening preferences are, and that'll help us understand how to make these shows better for you. Also, if you do subscribe in iTunes, please leave us some comments there, because Apple seems to really respect comments by listeners. And if you have good comments about us, that will raise us in the rankings and they will promote this show. Also, another announcement, if you will indulge us, Broadway Stars went through a redesign and just launched this week, and we appreciate all comments. But it's going to sound strange. I especially appreciate negative comments, because it'll help us understand, you know, where we went wrong and understand how to make the site better for you. So while we'd love to have any of your feedback, even the negative feedback, don't feel like you're going to hurt our feelings, because it's important for us to understand what you would like to see on BroadwayStars.com. So next week, you guys are keeping busy, and what do you think? Are we going to be able to cover the 7 shows, or shall we take a run at just a few of them next week? Oh, next week we have Megan Hilty with us as well.
Right.
And so between Megan and the shows, we'll have to make a balancing act there. And then the following week on May 6th, we're going to have Ted Chapin from Rodgers and Hammerstein join us. And as we talk about a few
weeks. Good thing we're going to that Sound of Music, Michael.
Yes. We talk about the Sound of Music in a few weeks. All righty. So, on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway. Bye bye.
Bye. Books that need a cooking, and dirty brown envelopes stuffed full of cash.